Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Cynthia Morrow, our County Health Commissioner, who is going to introduce today's guest speaker. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's my distinct honor and pleasure. Where did you go? There you are. No, you can sit down and relax for a few minutes. To introduce New York State Commissioner of Health, Dr. Nirav Shah. I've had the pleasure of knowing him for a little over two years now. And I've really been impressed, I think, first and foremost, with how calm you always are. You know, I emulate that. And really by his extraordinary intelligence. And I think that probably for us, one of the most important things that he's a fellow upstate New Yorker, so from Buffalo, so he's used to this blustery, snowy, windy weather that we had this morning. He's an honors graduate of both Harvard and Yale School of Medicine. And I think what's really important for us this morning is to know his vision. And his vision is that New York State is a state where every resident has access to affordable health insurance coverage, high quality care, early screening, and other services to prevent chronic diseases and improve overall health. And he's here this morning to talk to us about Medicaid redesign. So Dr. Shah, welcome to Onondaga County, welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Cynthia. I am used to upstate weather, so this was not a surprise. But, you know, Albany, we don't have it as bad as we do in Buffalo and here. So, dusting off the snow from the car this morning was brought back memories. I wanted to talk to you today about a few things. And I know we have time for Q&A at the end. So I thought I'd start by telling you a few stories and then go from there. First, I want to tell an unusual story because I think it really sets the stage for what we're trying to do in New York. And the story is about a fire that occurred in 1997. This was a fire in a factory in a Toyota plant in Japan. On a Saturday morning, this plant burned to the ground. It was the only plant in all of Toyota that made this one part. It's called a P-valve. It's part of the braking system of every car, of all 14,000 cars that Toyota makes every day. You need a P-valve. And this was the only factory that made 200 variations of P-valves. $5 part. And Toyota, because of its lean manufacturing system, had 4 hours of supply of this part. There are about 20,000 parts in a car, but you need this one. And so 14,000 cars a day stopped being made. Experts said it would take 6 months to rebuild that factory and start rolling P-valves out again to make all those variations. 6 months. Just think of what would have happened to the Japanese economy. And it wasn't 6 months. It didn't take 6 months. It actually took 5 days before Toyota production lines started again. This was no miracle. This was because early that Saturday morning, before the fire had even gone out, all the distributors and suppliers, hundreds of different companies that supplied and worked with Toyota, heard about this and started faxing P-valve specifications back and forth. A sewing machine manufacturer, never made P-valves before, retooled over 500 hours straight and started making P-valves, 1, 2, 5, 10, 50 at a time. So by that Thursday, trucks started pulling up to Toyota full of P-valves. This was not any central command and control hierarchy from Toyota up to its suppliers and distributors saying, you must make P-valves. This was something organic, something from the bottom up. And what it represents is an ecosystem. An ecosystem that worked together organically to build and look for the survival of the greater good, of the organism that is Toyota. And what do we have in healthcare? It's exactly not an ecosystem. We have nothing like that. And what we're trying to do is build that. And over the last 2 years, under Governor Cuomo's leadership, we've made some real significant strides. You know, where were we about 2 years ago when we started all of this experiment under this administration? As you know, 17% of our entire gross domestic product goes toward healthcare. 17%. And what are we getting for that? Well, it's much worse health than most of the European countries that spend a lot less on healthcare. Fully one-third of every dollar spent on healthcare today is wasted. Redundant tests, covering your back for malpractice, things you don't need, things that don't add patient value, things that hurt patients. One-third of what we're spending as taxpayers is wasted in healthcare. And it's because we live in silos in healthcare. Hospitals don't talk to nursing homes. Nursing homes don't talk to primary care doctors. Primary care doesn't talk to public health. No one really talks to each other. We live in our own silo because, you know, I get paid in my hospital based on what I do to the patient. More care is better. The sicker they get, that's okay. I'm still getting paid more. They fall out of bed and break their hip, I'll get paid more. My patient gets an infection while they're in the hospital, I'll get paid more. So where are the incentives? I'm not saying that hospitals and others are trying to get you sicker, but they're certainly not in it to get you better today because of the fee-for-service system. You know, this treadmill of sick care rather than health care is what we're getting off of. In New York State, this was worse than everywhere else. Half of our budget, half of our state budget, fully $53 billion a year, go toward Medicaid. $53 billion a year. That's more than twice the national average on a per recipient spend for Medicaid. And every year, it grew by double digits, 13%, 12%, 13%, 14%, 13%, 13%. What does that mean? That means your taxpayers' dollars don't go toward my kids' education, because that gets squeezed out. Public schools, education, roads, everything else gets squeezed out for healthcare that's not even giving us value for our money. You know, we spent this much money, and yet we were last in the country in terms of preventable readmissions to hospitals. Last in so many quality measures, it was deplorable. And so when Governor Cuomo came in, he said, enough is enough. Let's figure this out today. We can't afford 13% growth every year. We can't afford an unbalanced budget. Figure it out today. And he convened something called the Medicaid Redesign Team, where he got 27 people around a table, all the stakeholders, unions, hospital management, nursing home, legislators, public health, everyone with, well, not everyone, but a lot of people with big stakes in healthcare and in Medicaid specifically. And he said, figure it out, or else Dr. Shah will figure it out for you. He had this thing called superpowers, where if we spend one penny more than 4% growth in healthcare, you know, we're 13%, 13%, we're going to cut that 13% to 4%. And if you spend one penny more than 4%, I can do whatever I want. I can cut you down to zero. I can cut that hospital down to whatever I want. Unlimited powers to cut the rates willy-nilly. That scared a lot of people. I don't think it's because I'm scary. I think it's because, you know, the thought that they would be totally out of control. And so they got together. And they went around the state and they got ideas. How do we cut Medicaid? How do we start producing value for the dollar spent? How do we give patients what they deserve, which is health, not just more health care? And we got over 4,000 ideas. You know, a woman in Buffalo came up to the podium. We had these public forums, and she said, Dr. Shah, every time I go home from the hospital, I get sent home in an ambulance. And that's a $400 ride. I know because I see the bills. I don't pay for it, but I see the bills. Couldn't you give me a $40 cab voucher and I could get home? Well, that makes sense. And we did that. And we saved tens of millions of dollars. Was it worse care? No. It's probably better. She got home faster rather than waiting for an ambulance. I didn't ask her why she was being discharged from the hospital 10 times a year, but anyway. But it was about choices. It was about what are we spending our money on. And I can tell you there was a lot of transportation coordinators in the Bronx run by the, I can say it here, the Russian mafia who were really upset. And we had death threats because we cut tens of millions of dollars out of their pocket by stopping ambulance rides, you know, all these things that just don't add to healthcare. Death threats against my employees. And there was a lot of waste to be taken out of that system. We found out of those 4,000 ideas, we collected them together and we proposed 79 of them, of which 78 were approved by the legislature as part of this package of reform. And it wasn't rocket science. It was about paying for prevention. You know, it was about stop paying for things that don't add value. You know, today, fully 23% of all angioplasties, when they put a balloon in the heart vessels and blow it up and open it up, 23% of elective angioplasties in the state of New York are inappropriate, according to national guidelines. Inappropriate. That means they're doing harm to you by doing this angioplasty. We have really good data. We have a registry. All the doctors are reporting. This is national American Heart Association guidelines. And one in five, almost one in four, should not be done. And we pay $14,000 a pop for these, on average, for tens of thousands of these procedures. Are doctors doing the wrong thing because they want to do the wrong thing? No. But the incentives are such that, you know, oh, it looks blocked. If it was my mother, maybe I would get the angioplasty. It can't hurt. Well, it can hurt. And so what we're going to do in Medicaid is we're going to stop paying for them. You've got 3 years, cardiologists, before every single inappropriate PCI, inappropriate angioplasty, you will get $0 for that. And already, just the threat of that has cut the inappropriate rate in half in a year. We've built up, so we're ending the fee-for-service system because we know that causes inefficiencies. We're moving people toward care management. And care management, when we talk about care management, it's just not managed care of the 80s. People confuse what we did in the 1980s in this country with managed care was a vast experiment which basically closed the spigot. Everyone's getting paid less. And that's not what managed care is about today. Managed care today is about value. It's about quality. It's about accountability. It's about feeding data back to doctors on what they're doing right and what they're doing wrong. And suddenly, it leads to better outcomes for patients. And we have a 97% satisfaction rate in our Medicaid managed care plans. 97%. People love Medicaid managed care because it works. It gives them what they need. It leads to better outcomes. It keeps them healthy. That's what we're moving toward. So end of fee for service. Doctors get scared. How am I going to get paid? You know, I do colonoscopies. Every time I do a colonoscopy, I get paid $100 or $1,000. What does managed care mean to me? Well, it means you're only going to be doing colonoscopies when they're fully indicated, warranted, on the right patients at the right time, all of that. And you're going to get data back from your managed care company saying, you know, compared to other doctors, you're doing them half as good or better. And you'll have that data in real time. That's what managed care means. So it's about accountability. The other thing that we've done is investing in new models of care. We know that high-quality primary care helps people stay well. It's something called patient-centered medical homes. And so we're actually putting new dollars on the table saying if your doctor uses electronic health records, you know, uses all these nice standards, they will be paid more money. Of course primary care doctors should be paid more. They're the least paid and they probably do the most thinking of any other doctor out there. They're the ones who can keep you better. So primary care, investing in primary care is one way. We're strengthening the node, the most important node of the ecosystem of healthcare that is totally undervalued. We're strengthening primary care with this Medicaid redesign. Another thing we're investing in is something called health homes. And health homes means, you know, there are lots of patients who have two or more chronic conditions, hypertension, diabetes, asthma, you know, heart disease. When you have two or more chronic conditions, you become eligible for something called a health home. Patients with two or more chronic conditions are the small percentage of patients in the Medicaid system that account for the vast majority of costs. It's not rocket science. And they bounce between the hospital and the nursing home and primary care and all these other settings and home care without these different nodes talking to each other. So we're putting new dollars on the table saying, let's invest in care coordination. Let's build the bridges for these chronic patients, you know, with more than one chronic condition, so that medication reconciliation actually happens. When you get discharged from the hospital and you go to your primary care doctor, they're both looking at the same list of medications. Makes sense, right? Well, it costs money. We're investing in that. And by building up health homes for those chronic patients, once you've built the bridges between all these different silos, those bridges will be used not only by the chronic patients, but by everyone. And so we're building up the ecosystem with health homes and primary care and patient-centered medical homes. And we're achieving something the feds call the triple aim. Better quality care, better health for the population, and lower cost. In the first year alone, we saved $4 billion. That's with a B. And over the next 5 years, we estimate we will save a total of $34.3 billion for taxpayers with these redesigns. And it's not just cutting money out of the system. It's actually investing in better outcomes. Many of you know what a pressure ulcer is. People in nursing homes often get pressure ulcers. It's unacceptable. They're avoidable. We know they are. We invested $1 million in a gold stamp pressure ulcer reduction program as part of these initiatives. And that $1 million took our $105 million a year annual spend on pressure ulcers to $77 million in just a year. $1 million, $28 million in savings. Not to mention fewer people with pressure ulcers, which are painful and, you know, not a good thing to have. Today, our rate of pressure ulcers, which had historically been in the double digits, 10%, 12%, 15%, is down to 7.7%. Kaiser, their goal was 1%. They are down to 0.55%. New York State needs to meet Kaiser's goals. We will get there. And it's about making the right investments. It's not rocket science. It's actually very easy to do. You know, we changed the generic substitution rate. When you go and get your Lipitor, well, you could get the name brand Lipitor, or you could get a generic, which is the exact same med made on the same factory lines, but it isn't Lipitor. Right? Does that save money? We move from a 79% generic substitution rate up to an 84% generic substitution rate, meaning more people get generics, same medicine. That saved us $425 million last year. All these things are real money that add up and that allow us then to make more investments in the healthcare delivery system. Where is all of this leading to? Some of you may have heard something called an accountable care organization. What is that? Well, it's exactly that. It's under one umbrella. You've got hospitals and nursing homes and primary care and hospice and palliative care and all of these people and home care, everyone working together. And they're accountable for outcomes for the patient. This is what the feds want everyone to do. They want us to be accountable. They want us to work together. And when hospitals start to join these accountable care organizations, it really opens their eyes. Hospitals, instead of being revenue generators, suddenly become cost centers. And they say, I got to keep my hospital beds empty because we're losing money. As a whole, from a, you know, that a high perspective, if a patient is in the hospital, if I'm only getting $100 per patient, do I want to spend that $100, actually it'll be $1,000, on that hospital stay? Or do I want to spend 40 of it to hire a school nurse? And that school nurse is going to keep asthmatic kids well in school as opposed to in the emergency room or in a hospital bed that's really expensive. This is a big deal. Accountable care organizations are really the wave of the future, and we're getting there one way or another, whatever you want to call it. And it works. It's extremely destabilizing. Hospitals who are under the old model, they can't, you know, they want to fill their beds because that's the only way they know how to make money. Can't make it unless they change and shut down beds. On the other hand, you got to take those clinicians and workers and move them into primary care and into home care. Where would you rather get your care? Home, of course. Would you rather, you know, the hospital of the future, I've said this in the past, is an emergency room with an operating room above it and an ICU above that. You're not going to spend a month in a hospital. The nursing home of the future is that rehab facility. It's not a long-term convalescence facility. And then where do you age gracefully? At home, because that's where you want to, in supportive housing. You know, 5 years ago, about half the doctors in New York State were in private practice. And today, about 70% of them are employed in a large practice or by a hospital or by a large health system. Is it the end of private practice? I don't know. But when I go and see my one-off pediatrician who's a solo practitioner, and she's only open weekdays from, you know, 10 to 4, and flu shots, I got to take time off to get my kids flu shots. And, you know, I talk to someone else in the evenings and weekends who don't have access to my kids' records. Am I getting the value that I want? I love my pediatrician for my kids, but I want someone in a large group practice who's open late, who's open weekends, who has all that background support so that they remind me of the flu shots, not me taking my kids in for them. And that is the future. It's a customer-centric model. So unless you find a way to do that in solo practice, I don't know what's going to happen to you. But so far I've been talking so far about the 95% of where we spend our money. 95% of our healthcare dollar goes to the clinical delivery system. It goes to hospitals, and mostly hospitals, and primary care and others. Now I want to talk about the 5%, which is spent on prevention. Why is this important? And what is prevention? Well, prevention, here I'm talking about, everyone thinks they know what prevention is. Prevention is, oh, that's mammograms, that's, you know, flu shots, that's prevention, right? Yeah, it is. But it's more about health promotion. Let's rebrand prevention as health promotion. Now, that's a good thing. What's health promotion? It's keeping you healthy. It's making you more productive. It's letting employers have higher presenteeism as opposed to absenteeism. And health promotion, to maximize health promotion, you have to understand that a lot of healthcare is about the social determinants of health. What does that mean? Social determinants of health is education, poverty, housing. All of those matter much more to your well-being than anything we do in the healthcare delivery system. Really? All we're paying for, it's not helping my health? Well, just think of this. You know, cancer, we know that 1/3 of cancer is related to cigarette smoking. But another 1/3 of cancer is related to obesity, nutrition, inadequate physical activity. These are choices we make, knowingly or unknowingly. So fully two-thirds of cancer, the choice to smoke and all these other choices, two-thirds of cancer is related to our behaviors, not related to anything else we want to blame. And how do you start to attack that two-thirds problem? It's by focusing on the social determinants of health. Our zip code, where we live, is more predictive than our genetic code. And we need to start paying for some of that. I'll give you a real example. One day in the hospital costs Medicaid program $755. One day in a psychiatric inpatient unit costs us about $437. In the nursing home, we only pay about $280. In jail, it's $129 per day. In a homeless shelter, it's $68 per day. And in supportive housing, it costs us $47 a day. So we take 10,000 homeless people in New York City, put them in supportive housing. There are actually 28,743 people in the Medicaid program today who account for $1 billion a year of our spending who could use supportive housing. What is that? It's a house. It's an apartment with some social work services downstairs or some substance abuse treatment or some mental health services. One person working to help 40 residents. Cheap. Housing is healthcare. Who would have guessed? But it is. And it's a lot cheaper than my inpatient Medicaid days that we're paying for today. Housing is healthcare. Food is healthcare. You know, where you live matters. This is what we're finally realizing. And today, we're spending only 5% on all of that stuff. We're spending 95% after it's too late, when you're already sick. Let's try to balance that ratio a little better. I'd like to see 95% toward health and wellness and 5% toward sickness. But, you know, we do need to take care of our sick people too. So let's get there slowly. Let's try to get to 10% for health. You know, when you start talking about health, instead of talking about health care, you start asking very different questions. I want to maximize the health care of my community. That means you want to build lots of hospitals and you want to build lots of nursing homes. I want to maximize the health of my community. Ah, I want to build sidewalks. I want to build bike lanes. I want that school gym to be open evenings and weekends so everyone can take advantage of it. It's a lot cheaper. It's a lot better. We can get there, but we need to start asking about health. All these politicians come up to me, Dr. Shah, you got to save my hospital. I'm like, well, what do you want? Well, I want those jobs. Well, what do you really want? Well, I want the health of my community. Oh, well, if you want the health of your community, you can save those jobs. Just put them over there in this part of the health system and invest in these things at a fraction of the cost of trying to save that hospital. We need hospitals. I'm not saying we need to shut down hospitals, but we are certainly overbedded in New York State. You know, I'm going to talk about one more thing and then leave my some extra time for questions. I think there's a lot we should talk about today. And this is something we call a health in all policies approach. You know, I talked to you about how housing is healthcare. We can make a much bigger difference by thinking about health in all our other areas of life. Roads, smart energy, smart cities, all of that can make a much bigger impact. And we have data to back this up. Back in the 1960s, Congress passed something called the Clean Air Act. You know, you got to put these things to stop the pollution, you got to put filters on power plants, and don't pollute your environment so people can breathe, basically. Did it work? Well, it certainly cost a lot of money. It cost businesses from 1960s onwards about $500 billion to comply with the Clean Air Act. $500 billion. But what were the health implications? Well, the health implications were pretty astounding. 186,000 people per year between 1970 and 1990 for each of those 20 years. 186,000 people a year did not die because of the Clean Air Act. You know, asthma, COPD, congestive heart failure. They didn't die across America because of the Clean Air Act. And how much money did it save the healthcare system? $22.2 trillion. You never hear of a trillion in a positive sense, but here's one example. We save trillions of dollars by thinking about health, or just from a health perspective, with the Clean Air Act. Now imagine if we started thinking about that in transportation and in other areas. Wow, life would be better. So it's really not that complicated. It's actually quite simple if you start thinking about health and not just health care. And I have to end with one more story because I love this story. You know, in the 1960s, almost 45 years ago, actually, yeah, 45 years ago, Jack Geiger was a doc who started the first community health clinic. And this was one of those federally funded health clinics. And time and again, he saw mothers and their children come into that clinic hungry. It's a health clinic, and they're coming in hungry. So what did he do? He started writing prescriptions for food. And local grocers would fill those prescriptions and send the bill to the clinic, and the clinic would pay off those bills. Some nervous federal bureaucrats, after some time, went up to the good doctor and said, "Dr. Geiger, we really want you to stick to established treatments." And to this, the good doctor responded, "Last I checked, the best treatment for malnutrition is food." So it's really quite simple. Thank you.